All right, I think we've got our first group on here, and I'm sure others will join as we go. But we've got a great turnout for what I think is going to be a really special event. So welcome everybody for joining. I'm here in Nyala. I feel so gratified to be here, and I miss you all. The halls are empty, but we have a great session today and a great turnout of people. This is a Women's Influence Network event, and it's a part of a kind of a series that we're starting to really profile key women across Bridgewater that are doing really interesting work. And today we've got really an exciting conversation where we have three of our senior women in the research organization: Karen Carneal Tambor, Rebecca Patterson, and Erin Miles. Karen has been at Bridgewater since 2006, hard to believe, and is a director in investment research. Rebecca has been at Bridgewater for about a year, also a director in investment research after a 20-year career in investment management. And Erin and I both joined Bridgewater at the same time in 2009, which seems like about 1,000 years ago, but we've both been here 11 years. So I'm so excited to be part of it. My job today is really just to try to guide the conversation. There's so much to talk about, and with three people talking, it's hard to make sure we get everybody's views in. And so what I'd like to do is kick it off by asking a couple questions to each of our three participants, and then sort of just let the conversation go where it may. And then towards the end, with the last 20 minutes or so, we'll open it up for questions from the audience. And the thing I want to start with is what's going on in the world and what's going on in research, because the three people we have today are sort of at the center of Bridgewater's engine, which is our research organization and how we invest our portfolio. And so let me start, if I can, with you, Karen, and give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of what's going on in the world. And in particular, when I talk to clients, I'm talking about why I think we're well positioned, given our fundamental, systematic, diversified way of investing, to take advantage of this world. But please give us some thoughts on that, and then I'll turn to the others.
Well, thanks, Dave, and thanks everyone for being on. This is a really exciting event to do this with you all. What I would say, to keep it short, is that coming in before there was ever a pandemic, we had a perspective on the world that whatever it is that causes the next downturn is going to be very dangerous to have a downturn in this environment, because you're already so many years after the financial crisis where interest rates are at zero, and that's typically the most, you know, kind of effective way you get out of a downturn. There's already been 10 years or so of money printing that squeezed risk premiums and so on. And so we really felt like our job was to prepare for the next downturn, but we didn't know what it would be. And as that downturn we didn't expect happened, we found ourselves in, I'd say, in some ways, an incredibly great position to be in, and that we've spent the last 10 years really preparing and studying and thinking, how would we handle a downturn in this environment? And what we had concluded was, well, the only way you could handle a downturn into those conditions is really to use monetary policy, i.e. the Federal Reserve printing money and so on, at the same time that you use fiscal policy, meaning Congress doing stimulus package, sending people checks and so on and so forth. That combination where you on one hand print money that could go anywhere, but there's no one really to direct it to, and on the other hand, very explicitly direct the money to those that need it in a downturn. We had spent, 10 years preparing for that, studying really deeply questions like, if you send household checks, how does that work? If you print money, where does that go? So in that sense, we were really well positioned. On the other hand, it's been a wild ride and a really exciting time in research. I'm sure you'll hear that from all three of Rebecca, Erin, and I, because a tremendous amount of things are happening in the world at the same time. Just to process and make sense of everything happening, I can't honestly imagine doing it without the context, without the 10 years we had spent sort of preparing and laying the landscape and thinking, how do these things work and what are the cause-effect linkages? But at the same time, we had the joke on my team that we had someone relatively junior, but very, very talented, a guy named Hemant, process one particular change in policies. And we said, this is so great, he's doing it himself, but it's just a small change in policies. He's only been here a year. And someone said, well, you know, that little change was probably more action than happened like the 7 years ahead of COVID. And so it just gives you a sense of just the breadth of what was happening, the number of policies, the number of things happening, how fast things are moving with the virus. I'd say we probably doubled our research productivity in the last few months, just in terms of the pace we're going, in terms of being able to look out in the world, process all of that, come up with new ideas. And the third point I'd make is, look, we really looked at this period and said, this is a real sign that we've got to be much more innovative going forward, because the world is changing very rapidly. And the environment we were in for a decade before has kind of come and gone with this onset of this downturn, and now takes us into this next phase where you really have to run the economy differently. And that, I think, has been a really exciting change in mentality in research, the sense that, you know, while we're incredibly lucky to be as prepared as we are, and I can't imagine doing this without all the groundwork we laid, we have so much excitement ahead of us in terms of possibilities for innovation.
Great. Thanks, Karen. And let me get your perspective, Rebecca, because it's like you landed in Bridgewater in calmer times is a hard place to transition to when you're later on in your career. And here we are, you transition, and then all of a sudden the world fell apart. What's most distinctive in your mind about what you're experiencing at Bridgewater, and how's it different from what you experienced at JP Morgan and Bessemer?
Well, there's a lot different, obviously, but I'd say just picking up on the research process and what we're working on inside the investment research group, the biggest difference to me is the depth that we look at any single thing, whether it's a specific flow or a specific part of the market or policy drivers. And initially I thought, well, gosh, we need to move faster, and we are moving fast, trust me. But I think by taking that extra time to test things across history, to test things across countries, what we end up with is a view where we can have a lot more confidence. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. You know, we're not going to get it right every time, of course, but the more confidence we have that we haven't missed anything in the analysis, the more likely it is we're going to get it right. So I think just going into that extra second, third, fourth level of detail on every single little thing we want to investigate, to me, that is probably the singular biggest difference between how we do research here for our portfolio versus other places I've been in. And just picking up on what Karen said, you know, I'm part of the group right now doing additional digging on the fiscal. As she said, we've done a lot of work over the years already to have a really good understanding of how fiscal policy works, the different types of fiscal policy. So what I'm doing with a group of folks now is looking at where in history have we seen premature fiscal tightening, where politics or other factors have led them to take their foot off the gas too soon. We're looking at this election, obviously, in terms of fiscal policy. What does it mean if we have a Trump win, a Biden win, a sweep in Congress, not, et cetera? And again, to go to the depth, you know, I'm spending time thinking about 1876 contested elections. You know, it's good for me. I mean, where else do you get paid to get smart, right? So it's really interesting. Just when you think you know everything, after 20, 25 years in this business, you realize I don't know anything. And that's one of the cool things about being here, is we're always learning.
Yeah. I'll come back to that. There's some other things I want to talk to you about in terms of your Bridgewater experience. But Aaron, let me turn to you. You're co-leading a key pillar in the research organization. Focused on equities. There's been a big push over the last, really part of Game Plan 2.0, well before pandemic, to do create a much more granular understanding of equities, and a big research agenda that you've been an important part of. Tell us about that, and tell us what that's like in the last 6 months or so as we've tried to make sense of what's going on in the world.
Yeah, sure. So as you were noting, one of the key efforts that I've been leading over the past several years has been what we call economy bottom to top. So trying to develop our ability to really understand what's happening in the economy and markets in a granular way down to the level of the entities that are actually mattering. So whether that's down to the level of companies or down to the level of certain players, setting us up so that we can really process information at varying levels. And through the tremendous work from a group, engineers, technologists, investment associates, over, I'd say, the past maybe something like 3 years, we've gotten to a place where we came into this year, and it was, we were set up to be able to answer questions at just the right time. Because today, from the beginning of earlier this year, when we were asking questions like, what does the corporate hole look like? How big is the gap? As you've seen, in essence, this enormous decline in revenues that's rippling globally. And how is that impacting different companies? And you can't just understand that at the aggregate, because what really matters is the tail. If there's a tail of companies that are in a bad situation and don't have the money to come up with, then you're in real trouble, even if the average looks like it might be all right. And so we were wrestling with that and looking at the size of the gap that we saw, netting that against the fiscal and monetary stimulus that was coming out, which enabled us throughout, I think, through the beginning part of the year to be on top of really what was happening across countries and whether the stimulus efforts had been enough to really fill that gap in the way that was needed. And that continues to be a story now as we look and we see some of the questions like, what's going to happen? Are they going to pass the next phase of the plan in the US? And what does that mean? And what is the gap that's residual that has to still be filled? So that's kind of been like over the course of this year, how that's been coming to bear in ways that are bearing fruit. And then in addition, I think a lot of the ideas we have for new strategies and new indicators and new systems looking ahead are also benefiting from our ability to do research in that way. So one of the big things in terms of our investment thesis looking ahead is that today is a story of divergences, divergences across economies, divergences across different kinds of companies. And you've seen some of the work that Bob and Greg have shared in terms of looking at more resilient versus susceptible companies and their ability to weather this storm. We're also looking into doing work and understanding across countries, how do things like, you know, the tech story in the US versus, you know, the Europe and the European companies being behind for so long, how does that actually manifest in differences now looking ahead too? So I'd say both over the course of tracking this year and in addition, in terms of our research agenda looking ahead, it's been a huge asset to be able to answer questions in this way, both to complement our traditional macro trading, as well as to develop new strategies for trading groups of companies relative to one another.
Great. We'll come back to that too, and sort of your evolution in your career to the point you're at. Just a couple additional questions on the research team and the agenda, and then I want to switch topics. But Karen, and I'll ask you a version of this as well, Rebecca. What are you most worried about? So when you think about our need to evolve, you think about, you know, there's a transition going on in the investment engine. It's sort of like, I remember a couple points in my career, you're sort of in a tough situation, and you're thinking, well, somebody's got to do something. And then you look around and you say, wait, it's supposed to be me. Like I'm now at the point where I'm in charge, or I'm responsible for how we deal with things. And you know, all of you are in different ways sort of in that position. What are you worried about? What are the things that are on your mind most as we navigate our way through this?
Well, I loved how you said that, Dave, because that feeling of, wait a minute, there's so much to do and it's so difficult. Wait, we're the people. And specifically, you know, Aaron, Rebecca, and I'll play these very key roles and rely on each other to be partnering well together and realize that, you know, we obviously have some colleagues with us, but it's not that many of us. This is really on us. And that's a scary feeling. And what I would say I'm most worried about, honestly, is just true innovation is hard. It's easy to do what you've gotten used to. And we have a world-class set of people that are incredibly brilliant, that have worked together for a really long time and love working together. But at the same time, we face some of the biggest challenges we've ever faced just because of what the world is throwing at us. And true innovation is really difficult. And finding that balance between continuing to really hold each other accountable and have high standards, but at the same time, let each other grow and try new things and fail along the way, because true innovation probably requires some real failures, is going to be incredibly difficult. And we've got to branch out to things that we weren't necessarily experts in before. And so like when I look at, for example, what Aaron is leading on equities, I'm just so incredibly proud because it's something that is not something we have a 40-year history in. It's something that we've played around with and never really nailed the way we have other topics. And, you know, for her to take that leadership and, you know, with other really critical people say, I'm going to push forward and we're going to invent new things and some will work and some won't. That's a very difficult challenge. It's exciting, but it's really difficult. And having come out of an environment where we didn't nail it makes it even more that we all have to believe in each other and be willing to let each other fail as well as succeed together.
And Rebecca, what's the thing that as you've arrived and you look at, you know, you talked about the things that are great, but what are the things that you've not made sense of yet? I won't say they're bad yet because it's probably too early for you to figure out, you know, what's good and bad. But what are the things you're processing that you're trying to make sense of that that are most distinctive and, you know, are most unclear at this point?
Well, we definitely have a certain way of doing things that I think evolved with just how the firm evolved. You know, we started out with Ray and then Ray and Bob and their personalities and their strengths and weaknesses, I think shape who we are today, especially within the investment engine. You know, if you go over to Nyala, there's a different cadence in terms of meetings, when they start, when they end, how people interact with each other versus within the investment engine. And I'm not saying it's good or bad, it's just different. The one thing I will say it's just bad is that we don't tend to have a huge amount of respect for things starting and ending on time. And that's not how my parents raised me. So it makes me cringe every time it happens, but I'm trying to just get kumbaya with it or help affect change from inside. But other than that, it's just different. And so for me, what I'm trying to get comfortable with and understand and figure out the best way to get embedded in this well is how we communicate through a process. If we have a perception and that perception becomes an idea we want to investigate, and then we put resources against it to investigate it, and we go through the process of going from idea to something that could actually affect our systems and help performance, how that process happens, I think in part because we do have so much focus on intellectual property and security, which I completely respect and understand. But sometimes it can be hard to really understand everything that's going on. And especially for someone like me coming from the outside where I'm used to driving the car. And sometimes today I feel like, am I even inside the car? And I think increasingly I am, but it's very different. Sometimes it can be slightly uncomfortable. And I know at Bridgewater, it's all about being comfortable with being uncomfortable. But that's probably the biggest thing for me personally that I'm trying to move my own personal ball forward and loop on, to use the lexicon, so I can have as much impact as possible going forward.
Yeah, I remember that same feeling myself when I arrived 11 years ago. Well, I want to interject just a quick point, which is I want to thank Robin, who's the senior sponsor of the WIN Network, and Kate and Tara, who are the leadership. And have really done a great job. I've attended a couple of these events, and they're really—it's really a great part of our community. And Janani, who had the idea in CS, I believe, when they sort of had an initial version of this that we're rolling out here for the rest of the company. So thanks all for setting up this event. Aaron, I want to turn a little bit more to career and sort of development, and I'm going to come at it in different ways for each of you. But you've been very successful at Bridgewater within your cohort, taking on increasingly higher levels of responsibility within the investment community. Just to reflect back on that, those 11 years, coming right out of college, what have been sort of your milestones? Everybody talks about, or we talk about at Bridgewater, pain plus reflection equals progress. Talk about your journey here at Bridgewater a bit and the lessons that you might share with others who are at various stages of their own journey.
So I think for me, I think the biggest transformation, or I guess the biggest evolution over time, there have been many experiences, I've learned many things, but I think the biggest, like what I would call kind of pivotal part of my career trajectory, was a trajectory of confidence. So I came in and at first I would say I was definitely in the IA class. You know, we set up the room, it's something like 25 people sitting around a big table and there's someone in the middle talking and it's Socratic method. Everyone's jumping in and talking. And I was definitely the person who, if I spoke, you probably didn't hear what I was saying. And the only way I got to speak was by chugging. I used to literally, every morning I came in, I would take 2 cups of coffee and I would drink both of them. And I'd try to sit in the front row so the room felt small to me, because that was the way that I could actually get myself to speak up and feel comfortable speaking up, which I think derived a lot from a lack of confidence. I'd come from neurobiology. I felt like I don't know anything. These people all know more than me. There's a bunch of people who speak with such assertive confidence. And I think, you know, for over time, it took me a long time to find and figure out the right ways to establish my sense of self-confidence. And I think a lot of that came from working with great mentors over the course of my career, working with folks like Fred and Seth and Karen over time, who I think I learned and built a sense and a track record for myself of the things that I could do. And I also, honestly, I pursued a strategy probably something like 5 years in, which was a little bit of what I would call fake it till you make it, which is just put yourself out there and start saying it and speak confidently and be a voice in the room. And even if, you know, behind the scenes, I'm like, you know, my hands are on the chair like this, like just do it and just get after it. And so I think for me, I would say, honestly, the first 5 years of my career here, I think I was fine, but would you say I really stood out within the cohort? Like, of course, maybe in some ways, but I think really coming in about 5 years ago, it was kind of a pivotal change for me, which came, I think, in particular from just taking the attitude of throw myself in there, be the person who says, I want to teach the IA class and get in front of the room, even though that terrifies me. I'm going to speak up in what's going on in the world, even though that terrifies me. And just keep going at that until it was no longer that kind of an experience and actually the confidence was real. And I think that was huge. And I would just say, I remember looking back and in the early days, I just thought, this is who I am. I'm this kind of person. I lack confidence. And that's the way it's going to be. And the main thing I would say to people is that's, you can change and evolve in huge ways you don't even realize. And everyone, I think, has a different way to get there and different strategies, but just keep at it, because being the confident version of yourself and the decisive and the clear and the knowing what you want and saying it, I think is just such a powerful, much more powerful way to be.
That's great. And, you know, the thing I noticed all three of you have in common is that you didn't want to be investors. That wasn't where, you know, you didn't aspire, you didn't, you know, come out of grade school thinking you wanted to be at a hedge fund. And Rebecca, you have an interesting story because you started as a journalist, and in addition to, I guess, meeting your husband along the way, you also made a pivot into the investment world. Tell us about that. What was the path?
Sure. So I actually started out in school wanting to be an astronaut. So I studied aeronautical engineering. And then I think in my junior year of college, just looking for an easy credit so I'd have more time for football games, I took a journalism class and it was a light bulb moment. I loved writing. It came so naturally to me, whereas the physics came, but maybe not quite as naturally. So I changed. And after a year of grad school, I got a job in Washington writing about politics. And I was so happy. I loved it. Loved trying to understand how the sausage is made in Washington. Loved going to the press conference, seeing how it all unfolds. That led me overseas to graduate school, where in Italy, I covered Berlusconi's first election in Italy, was covering politics and economics in Europe. And then in the late 1990s, JP Morgan reached out to me and said, hey, we read your stuff in the Wall Street Journal and you seem to get it. Why don't you come work for us? And I thought, well, I don't know anything about banking. I don't know if I even balance my checkbook. And they said, no, we'll teach you. So I decided, well, what the heck? If I fail, so what? What's the worst that can happen? So I made the leap. And the first couple of years, I think I literally worked 7 days a week, exhausted, but I had so much I didn't know. I didn't know how to run regressions. I didn't know how to price forwards and options, but I was determined. And so I figured it out and I asked people for help and I got up the curve. And I realized that a lot of my journalism skills actually were really, really useful. In journalism, you're taught to think skeptically. Everyone you talk to, I know this sounds kind of dark, but everyone you talk to has an angle. They're coming from somewhere. And so understanding that is important. You learn how to communicate well and clearly. Hopefully I'm sort of doing that today. And you learn to be able to process things very quickly. And I think really importantly for Bridgewater, think laterally. to connect the dots, to see different pieces of data or news and say, what's the bigger picture here? And so I think all of that actually was incredibly helpful for me as I moved into investment banking at JP Morgan, initially doing research and then later into overseeing portfolios and running a trading desk and then to where I am today. So I went back to grad school twice to try to make up for my mathematical deficiencies. And I think hopefully I've achieved enough of that, that I'm in good shape today. So you definitely need that side of things, but the journalism I actually think has been incredibly, incredibly powerful and sometimes gives me a little bit of a comparative advantage, especially on days like yesterday, where we decided to write a daily observations about the implications of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing. And we had about 3 hours to figure it out and put pen to paper. And that's when I'm grateful I'm an ex-journalist, because I think I can do that quickly, but do it in a way that still gives insights for our clients.
You know about deadlines. Yeah, great. And Karen, you've, if I understand it correctly, had thought about being a PhD and pursuing a more academic research oriented career. When did you change your mind and why?
Honestly, I only changed my mind a few years into Bridgewater because I assumed when I was coming out of college that I would go and get a PhD and got recommendations in order and whatnot, and thought that I should have some real world experience first and shouldn't jump into it. But I never really thought I'd be at Bridgewater long term. I was I kind of fell in love with the firm meeting it, even though at the time people thought I was completely crazy for taking the job, because jobs at places like Lehman Brothers seemed significantly more stable and, you know, promising career paths. But what really spoke to me was this sense of people trying to understand what's happening in the world and make sense of it for themselves. And I thought that seems really right for me, but I didn't think I'd be doing it forever. And then, you know, a few years into Bridgewater, when it was kind of the natural time to say, do I want to go back to that plan? What really stuck with me was, first of all, wow, it is a lot of fun to be on a mission to understand things with other people rather than kind of being stuck alone in a room writing a book. An academic can spend 10 years in a room writing a book that 15 people will read. Man, this is such a fun community to have so many people that are with you, rowing the boat in the same direction, trying to learn with you. I love the intellectual passion of everyone in research and how much people like working together. Number two, wow, it's really a lot of fun learning about the world if you can also see impact out the other end. And academia is very difficult to really know what impact are you having. And some academics are incredibly lucky in that they both get to think about something they love and they get to see the impact. Some academics don't really care about the impact. But at Bridgewater, I thought it was just addictive how fast, you know, you could really feel the impact, whether it was, you know, our clients that are these huge pools of money around the world that makes a big difference, what happens to them. For them who are pensions, their beneficiaries, the distance between an idea to actually making money in the markets and getting the feedback. And of course, our relationships with policymakers and all of that. It seemed like, wait a minute, if I'm really enjoying, I think I want to be an academic because I thought that's the way to do the most interesting things in the world. And I thought, I'm doing the most interesting things I can imagine, but with a team, a lot more fun, together on a mission, and with the impact being so much more obvious, why would I leave again? So I decided to stay.
Yeah. Well, one thing, just a follow-up for you. One of the things I've noticed, and you know, we've worked together for a long time now, is increasingly your interest, passion, competence in dealing with clients. And I think one of the things that I see motivating you, at least from my standpoint, is that engagement, knowing that you're helping them, not only with hopefully great returns from our portfolios, but really helping shape their broader perspective in a way that helps them achieve their goals. Talk a little bit about that as one of your personal drivers and ambitions.
It made a huge difference in how much I loved the job and in how good I was at it once I started seeing clients. Basically, if I take my first 7 or 8 years, I think the thing that Bob and Greg kept saying to me was, you know, I think your interest in this topic is a little bit academic, you know, like you're interested in theory, but it's not, you're not a trader at heart. It's not like you're dying to, you know, prove that tomorrow's trade will be right and you'll make, you know, another $100. And I was sort of like, why would I care about that? I'm doing this because it's interesting. I don't actually care about that. And I think that was a tough thing to reconcile. And they kind of said, well, that's our business. And then Bob, who has been an incredible mentor to me, kind of said, I think you're at a stage where you should start seeing clients. And as soon as I started doing that, it clicked in this completely different way, which is, of course I care about tomorrow's performance because I know who it's going to. I know why it matters to them. I know what difference it makes to them and how they're thinking about their circumstances. And so it became really connected to impact and a lot less theoretical, and became a lot more fun to be doing the job, kind of knowing who are the people who the impact is really on and what's it like for them and their circumstances. And I think we're a really unique place in how much we care about really putting ourselves in the client's shoes and understanding their circumstances. And that became something I got really passionate about. And I think then circled back and maybe a lot more effective at the research.
That's great. Aaron, you made the point that mentorship had been such an important thing for you. And each of you are playing formal roles and informal roles in building our community. And in particular with diversity and inclusion, you all have had or play very prominent roles in that particular sub goal, but the broader goal of managing our community and our talent. And I wondered if you could talk about that a bit, but talk about it through the lens of mentorship and how you think about that as someone who's been both the beneficiary of it and as someone who I know plays that role for others.
So in terms of, I think mentorship is a key part of anyone's career trajectory. To me, I think that the ability to visualize ahead and think, who do I want to be or what do I want to look like 5 to 10 years down the line, and having people who are mentors and coaches who partner with you, who you can actually understand as people and get like, okay, this is how they actually got there, and then also get their coaching and advice for you on going through your career. I think it's obviously such a key accelerant for many people in their careers. And to me, I think, you know, one of the key threads of the D&I initiative is making sure that everyone throughout the community really feels like there are great mentors in that way for them. Because I do think it is much easier. It can be easier to identify with and build relationships with folks. If you feel like this is someone who's another woman, or this is a man, or someone of a similar background or ethnicity, and making sure that we're really forging those bonds across the entire community is, I think, critical. So that's mostly what I'd say. And I think, so I'll turn it to the other folks too.
Great. And Karen, this specific question for you, you know, we use the word systemization in how we think about research. But one of the things that I've observed, and you've been a key part of it, you've been a key leader in this effort, is the way that you and others have systematically built the IA community. Everything from the way we recruit to the way we educate and train to the way we compensate, assess. It's been quite remarkable, at least through my eyes. Talk about that a bit, and the role that you've played in it, and how you see that community evolving today.
Well, I think that I've really been one of a group of people, and that, you know, Greg Jensen, who I give Greg the most credit and kind of, being an originator of this, realized early on that it would take a group, that one person couldn't build a community, that you needed a group of people that took on different responsibilities, but that it still all had to come together, and that it needed the different elements. It needed the teaching, the actually taking people and investing in them, taking real time, not judging them, but teaching them and trying to give them skills. Then it needed real assessment. We needed to be intellectual Navy SEALs. So we had to be able to say, some people are just not going to fit and it's not going to work. and be tough and give people really tough feedback and tough love at the same time. And then it also needed the relationships that we needed to actually build real relationships. It's a lot easier to take harsh feedback when you really believe that we're part of the same team trying to make each other better and you get to know the people personally. And like Aaron was saying, you get much stronger inspirational mentors when you really know them and know what it's like and know what they're feeling. That all three of those pieces had to come together. And then in addition, you also needed passion, actually people getting excited about the mission, about the content, about what we're doing. So to me, those have always been kind of the four pillars that you had to balance correctly. And if you dropped one, it stopped making sense. If you got too soft, the community got too weak. If you weren't investing enough in teaching people, you lost people that were good because you didn't invest enough. If you didn't have close enough bonds, people didn't want to stay because they didn't love it. And if you don't have the content, you know, it's not exciting to really be on this mission. And I think different people have played roles at different times in making each of those four kind of, you know, line up and balance and make sure that all those things are happening. And I've personally enjoyed my role in all of those. I love teaching the investment class when I did it. Even doing things that are painful, like standards and assessments and reviews, I've felt that I personally enjoy doing because I love knowing what was happening with people's careers and giving them career advice. We have tons of amazing social events, and I love talking about the markets with people. And different people have really contributed kind of in the way that was right for them. And to me, that's a model of how to build a community and how to make sure that different people, as they come up in that community, can contribute to building the rest of it in whatever part speaks best to their personality and contribute in the way that's right for them, seeing that we need all those different types of contributions to really have a strong community through time.
And talk a minute, and Rebecca, I'm going to ask you to reflect on the same question. You and I have talked many times over the years, but particularly in recent years, about why diversity and inclusion is so central to having that community be truly excellent. And you've obviously played a big role in making sure that that's a priority within the investment engine. But talk about that as an aspiration and why it's so central to your work and to what you think we need.
Well, at some level, I think it's simple in the sense that this is a really, really hard job. We interview, I can't even tell you how many people, and we interview a lot fewer people than apply. This is something that, you know, it's one in hundreds that are going to make it. And it's so hard for us to find that talent. It would be incredibly, incredibly stupid for us to narrow the universe of talent we can look at because we're messing up on inclusion and people don't want to come. That would be incredibly, incredibly stupid. And so if we find people that are good, we should do everything to make them successful. And we got to realize that different people need different things to be successful. For example, when I joined, there really were no female IAs. There really weren't any. There was one or two. They kind of transitioned out of markets. And Robin Shepherd played this incredible role of creating this mentor, mentee, broader set of women relationships across the firm that was part of what I needed. It didn't have much to do with the investment stuff, but it was a set of relationships and mentorship and community that I needed to be comfortable at Bridgewater. And she set that up, even though, you know, she wasn't close to the investment community. It's not that different than the fact that now when we have some new hires that come from the UK, they need different things to get adjusted here than somebody who went to school down the street at Yale. They're moving across the world and need a different kind of support. And so to me, we have so little talent at this quality. We got to invest in every person that can make it, and we got to figure out what they need to make it great for them. And the last piece, which probably seems obvious, is that it's really hard to predict what creates diversity of thought. It's so hard to get the right quality people. And then at the end, you want to sit around the table with 5 to 7 really smart, passionate people that are going to bring something different to the conversation. And diversity is just one other measure where you're raising your probability. You'll actually get different independent thinking that'll add to the conversation in a different way and make our intellectual environment more enriching and raise the probability of getting to the right answer. And it's just another reason we absolutely can't give up on that.
Great. Rebecca, I'm gonna have my last question for you. And then Karen, I'm gonna go to the chat room. I wanna ask you a question about China from Noam, so you can think about that for a minute. And then I'm gonna ask Emily's question to all of you about your external networks. But before I do that, Rebecca, you just did this interview with Tom Keene, which the part I saw you did a really nice job on, and you answered about what surprised you most about the community, which really resonated with me because it's the thing I say, which is the thing that surprised me most too. And I wondered if you might talk a bit about that, because it's so interesting to see it through someone else's eyes that hasn't been here. And would love to just get your thoughts on that, as well as, you know, diversity as you've experienced it in other places and as you come here.
Sure. What I've experienced here is a place that is incredibly humbling. You know, I came in here with a decade-long track record investing. I did really well, and I get here and I feel some days like I'm learning it all over again and questioning everything I thought I held true and pushing myself to understand things at a deeper level. So it's humbling. And I think the second thing, if memory serves right now, that I told Tom Keene was that it's also one of the most authentically caring communities I've ever worked with. And I say that from the heart. I mean, I have a meeting later this morning with Greg Jensen to talk about some of the election related work we're doing. And I had a colleague, Kevin Brennan, pinging me this morning saying, hey, do you need anything for the meeting? Do you feel like you're in good shape? People do that all the time about everything. You know, everyone wants to help you. Everyone is being supportive. At most firms, you're going to have at least a small cadre, sometimes a big one, that's really looking, how do I get ahead by pushing you down? And I just don't see that here. I think we're a small enough and tight enough community that those people just wouldn't survive. So the fact that there are so many ridiculously smart people here, but then on top of that, to have everyone so focused, so caring, it is really a special place. It's not perfect, but it is a special place. And on the D&I, just real quick, David, you know, I have always sought out leadership roles in D&I at past firms. I'm a mom of two daughters, so it's a personal passion of mine. And I was really, really happy when Sean McRae asked if I would partner with him and Steve Krieger, Alex Valdez, some others. And we're really trying to look at the investment engine in particular and say, what else can we do to make it stronger? And one thing we're doing right now is having coffee chats with every single person within the department who is from a diverse background. And of course, anyone who's not, who still wants a coffee chat, we're happy to do that. That's inclusion. But we're starting with this group to find out, where do we stand? What's going well? What should we prioritize going forward that can really impact people's lives and make us more inclusive? And that's just been an amazing exercise, getting to know colleagues better, understanding the firm better, and seeing what we can do to make sure the community, as Karen said, gets stronger and stronger on every level we can.
Great, thanks. And we've got about 10 minutes left, and I don't want to get bad dots from Rebecca, so I'm going to end on time. So I'm going to ask you to keep your answers short, because I want to draw everybody in a bit for the remaining 10 minutes. Maybe I can turn to you, Aaron, on the question of, you know, how do you think about, you know, for all its great things we've talked about, Bridgewater is a pretty insular place in the sense that we're all here out in the woods in the middle of nowhere talking to ourselves. And so how do you maintain that connectivity? Or have you had struggled to maintain that connectivity outside of Bridgewater in terms of personal networks and support structures and so forth?
So one, I think I definitely have someone who I think needs to work on that more. And I do think in general, I think it's an important thing for us as an investment community to keep working on, because I do think, and more recently, I've been trying to do more of this. I've been trying to reach out in particular and work on having the connections and the conversations with people who are adjacent to our space. So you can have good, thoughtful back and forths and go back and forth on a particular topic or question, which to me, I think is so important, just to actually bringing in new ideas and different ways of thinking, because we as a group, you know, we're doing What's Going On in the World every single Monday. We're all in a constant conversation with each other. And if you're not bringing in that kind of thinking, I think you're missing out in a huge way. So I've been trying to develop a network of folks who are spanning across kind of what I would call is adjacent areas to what we're doing, you know, not literally doing the same thing, but who might be involved in policy or involved in private equity and things like that, which I found very fulfilling, both from the perspective of building that relationship network and from drawing in different external perspectives. So that's how I've thought about it. I think, you know, folks like Rebecca, we've had a few conversations actually where I've kind of been looking to Rebecca for advice and coaching on this, because I think we are in the woods, we are out here. And I think there's a lot of folks who probably do this a lot better than what I've been doing. So.
Karen, could you comment on that? Both how you maintain your connectivity, both how you think about profile and all that stuff. And then I do want you to ask you to comment briefly on China. So if you could do part A and a part B, I'd appreciate it.
Part A, agree with all the challenges. The best advice I've given to people is you have to actually make it a priority. And however it is you set your priorities, whether it's like you need time in your calendar or it needs to be one of the things you want to do and accomplish in a certain quarter, you need to actually proactively say, this is how I get my outside connectivity, and it is a priority, so it doesn't drop by the wayside. On China, what I would say is, you know, there hasn't been a lot of change probably from what's been discussed before, meaning China is by far the fastest growing liquid market in the world. It was basically unavailable to Western investors until pretty recently, and it's going to be one of the largest markets in the world. So we would be very unwise not to put huge investments behind understanding it. We're making a lot of those investments within research. And then, you know, we have actually an incredibly talented woman, Joanna Sun, that rejoined Bridgewater after running her own fund outside of Bridgewater, that's running our onshore China efforts, which is a really exciting set of efforts to literally be on the ground and managing money there, really complementary to what's happening with us managing money for foreign investors, kind of routing into China to be on the ground working with Chinese investors. But the big picture is this is a huge opportunity. And because of what Ray has done for us as a firm in terms of building relationships there all the way from the time that I was probably a baby going there and getting to know people and building relationships with few Westerners had, we really have an opportunity to get involved in what's going to be a very big and exciting set of markets that provide a lot of diversification.
And Rebecca, you know, I reread your bio this morning, and, you know, you've had two stints at two great institutions prior to coming here, JP Morgan and Bessemer. But I also noticed that you've got, you know, an array of things that you're involved in, the Economic Club of New York, the Council on Foreign Relations. Talk a little bit about this, because I think you probably have the most experience, obviously outside of Bridgewater, on this topic. Talk about creating, in the best sense of the word, a network of support, reinforcing relationships that can help mentor, coach, give you new ideas, new thinking, and make you a stronger executive and a stronger investor.
Well, I think there's two ways you could attack the question. There's the internal within Bridgewater, and then there's the external. Internally, what I always tell people is just don't be shy about reaching out to someone and saying, you know, I guess today, can we have a virtual coffee or a virtual glass of wine? I'd just love to get to know you and what you do better, just a half hour. And most people can find a half hour in their calendar somewhere. And I think that's a great first step, because you're going to learn something. You might make a new friend. And then the next time you have a question, you know where to go, or they can guide you on where to go. So I think just doing that, and honestly, making it part of your regular schedule. You know, I want to make sure I have a coffee chat at least once a week with somebody inside the firm. And when I first joined here and I was doing boot camp over in Nyala, every second I had free, I was squeezing in coffees and lunches with as many people over there as I could, because I wanted to have a good sense of where I worked. What was the holistic Bridgewater, not just the investment engine? And it was great. I met so many great people. So internally, I think all of us can do a better job of that. We all get so busy with our day to day, and networking is not a priority, and it probably shouldn't be, but we can all carve out some piece of time in our schedules to do that. And I think it can help us all in so many ways. So I would advocate for that. On the external stuff, you know, I think you have to be choosy, because none of us have a lot of free time, and it does take time. And especially when we get back to a normal world, driving from Westport to New York City, for example, for a lunch or a forum is not exactly a small amount of time. So you have to think strategically, what am I trying to get out of this? What's my goal? And then once you figure that out, what do I want to learn more about? What am I passionate about? What is it that's going to make me happy and excited? And in my case, I love economics. I love history. Probably no surprise I ended up here eventually. And so things like the Economic Club of New York or the Council on Foreign Relations are just great fits. Today there's a lot of virtual stuff, but what I think is important about these that perhaps people don't understand, and I'm sure you do, Dave, is that every one of these things, as long as you're willing, like Aaron said, have your coffee, get yourself geared up, and then you just have to go for it. And honestly, I've had those moments too, plenty of times. You know, if I'm at the Council of Foreign Relations and I'm around a table with 10 people and three of them are former Treasury secretaries, okay, I'm intimidated. But I also know that they're just human beings. We're all here to talk with each other about a topic and what the heck. So I go and I introduce myself and I give them a business card and sometimes I follow up. And as a result of that, I get to know them. And then they introduce me to someone else and they introduce me to someone else. And suddenly you have this amazing network and you have to nurture it like a friendship, but it can be incredibly powerful over time. So it's being choosy about your goals. And then once you're in the setting, then you got to work it. And that's not always comfortable, but I think it pays great dividends.
Great, 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 great advice. Okay, I'm going to ask you to all, and I mentioned to you when we did this prep call that I wanted to sort of ask you to look forward a bit. And I'm going to ask you to do that briefly. And you can tackle however you want it, but think about 5 years from now. Let's imagine things go really great over the next 5 years at Bridgewater and for you personally. You can take either side or both. You know, what would you be doing 5 years from now? What does Bridgewater look like 5 years from now that would make you excited and motivated and energized and a vision that you're excited about pursuing? If I could maybe start with you, Aaron, ask you to just comment and then with you, Rebecca, and then end with you, Karen.
Yeah, so I think to me, when I think 5 years ahead, I think the power of Bridgewater and of this group is really in the group. And so for me, when I look 5 years ahead, I'm already moving into more leadership positions. And to me, the thing that's most important is being a leader who leads not through my own strength, but through bringing out the strength of the group and the differential strength of everyone who's in the organization. And I really do believe that we still have untapped potential in terms of the level of collaboration and how much greatness we can get out of the people that we really do have here. And so getting to a place that 5 years from now, we're like, yes, this is a group that literally brings out the best in every single one of the people who are around the table and we're collaborating and building off of one another. That to me is something that I'm deeply passionate about. And I believe we still have room to run in terms of getting there.
And Rebecca, you?
I'd like to just say ditto, but I guess I can't get away with that. So that was great, Aaron. I think, you know, 5 years from now, I also would like to be an increasingly impactful leader at the firm. However, I can do that most effectively for Bridgewater. And I hope I can do that in lots of different ways. In terms of Bridgewater itself, 5 years from now, I hope to see a firm that's even more diverse. I think we are diverse, especially compared to a lot of our peers out there, but I know there's more we can do. So being more diverse and inclusive, which I genuinely believe will help our bottom line and also make us a better place to work, as well as just being the right thing to do. I think 5 years from now, I'm excited to see what new solutions we're offering for clients. I think we'll continue to be innovative. We have to be. Dave, you talk about this all the time. I agree. And I think we're going to move into new areas that maybe today we're not even sure we're thinking about right. I think Aaron's thoughts on equities is a great corner of that. I think the ESG work that's been led by Karen and a lot of others is a really exciting path. I'm sure that's going to build. And hopefully I can contribute to some new paths that we take as well, just to make sure we're serving our clients, whatever their needs are, whether it's 5 years from now or 20 years from now. And I guess last, you know, when I think about this firm and what we can do better, what we look at like 5 years from now, I feel confident that we'll keep compounding on the 40 years we have already. And how can we utilize that even better in our communications, in our research, to differentiate ourselves in the marketplace? I feel like we have so many comparative advantages versus our peers. And I'm excited to think about over the coming years, how we can pull that out and leverage it even more to our advantage. Because I think it is truly one of the unique things about us. And it's powerful. We do a lot with it, but I bet there's even more in there.
Thank you. Karen?
Wow, so much ditto that one of the really exciting things is just working with people that you feel like you have a shared vision with. The only things I would add are, you know, I hope that we are on a great path to have a strong and diverse investment committee, meaning a group of people that is diverse, that has a variety of members that each both lead their own initiatives and are able to together really determine the course of how we invest money. I feel like we've seen a beautiful model of that from Ray, Bob, and Greg playing jazz together over the years and making decisions together and each bringing something. And in 5 years, we look and say, look at the investment committee that's now broader than Ray, Bob, and Greg, much more diverse and has that same ability to both pursue and each bring their own instrument and really make great decisions together. And I hope that it feels that way at the firm level too, that we keep the efforts that, you know, Dave, you have made and others have led to create also a firm-wide partnership where the firm leadership is a mix of the investment leadership and all the other leadership that we need that is diverse, strong, understand each other, each bring a different instrument to be playing. And that through that, I think that'll be our strength, the quality of the people we have and our ability to work together to navigate what I don't think any of us can imagine what the world's going to be in 5 years, given that I think anyone, if you asked them in 2015, where will you be in 5 years, would not have guessed anything similar to what's happening this year. What will carry us through is the strength of our relationships, our willingness to work together, innovate, try new things. I think we have some of the best quality people in the world, and we could be able to bring that together to keep building on the incredible things that Ray, Bob, and Greg have done over 40 years for at least another 40 to come.
That's great. Well, I'm a little bit over, Rebecca, but I think it was worth it. Let me just end by thanking you, all three of you. I feel like it was completely authentic and covered a lot of territory, and I really appreciate you guys spending the time. And I'm really proud, that to have you as colleagues, that you're, you know, key leaders in our organization. And I'm really grateful that everybody else got to hear a bit more about all of you and from you today. So thank you. I think this was very helpful. Great, great success. And I really appreciate it. And everybody involved, thanks for coming and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Everybody have a good one.